With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Frank Sheeran. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you said it right.
Under the contract, management can only fire a driver on very specific charges. So, you have a show up late?
No.
Do you have any moving violations?
No.
Do you drink on the job?
No.
You ever hit anybody?
On a job?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
All right, then. We don't have nothing to worry about.
Today we're at Industrial Light and Magic to meet with the Irishman's visual effects supervisor, Pablo Hellman. Martin Scorsese's The Irishman has generated considerable attention for the de-aging of actors Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci, enabling the actors to play their characters over several decades. And Hellman is here to give us a deep dive into ILM's newly developed process. Hellman is a two-time Oscar nominee for 2005's War of the Worlds and 2002's Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. His credits also include Jarhead, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and Martin Scorsese's Silence. I'm Carolyn Chardina. Welcome to the Hollywood Reporter's Behind the Screen. Pablo, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
There's been a lot of attention on your work on The Irishman for the de-aging process of Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and Al Pacino. For starters, what did you discuss with Marty and what was the purpose of creating this new process?
Well, our discussion started about 4 years ago. It was 2015. We were doing Silence in Taiwan, and I had heard that he was doing Sinatra next. And so we started talking about film, of course, over Thanksgiving dinner, and I pitched to him the idea of doing a young Sinatra. And he said, you know, tell me more about it. He's a very curious person. And I told him a little bit about, that was basically going to be the next frontier in visual effects. And he said, well, you know what, I'm not doing Sinatra, but there's a project that I have called The Irishman that it sounds like, you know, we could use some of that. So he emailed me that script overnight. And the following day we were shooting. And I read it overnight. And it was an incredible, all 157 pages of the script. So I said, you know, look, we're in. I hadn't talked to ILM yet, but I said, you know, I'm sure that we can do, you know, a test of some kind. So he said, great. We talked to the producers. He said, why don't we talk back in New York? So about 6 months later, I got a call. I was in New York doing another project, and I got a call from Marty saying, you know, we want to talk about this test. And he said, I got to tell you that if we do a test of something, we cannot use any kind of tracking markers. You know, all that, you know, paraphernalia that you guys put in front of us, we cannot use, because we're going to use Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci. And they are completely method actors, and they're not going to go for anything. And so we talked about a test. We did a test on a scene from Goodfellas, the pink Cadillac scene. And there I was. You know, we were in New York, and Bob De Niro showed up, 74 years old. He reenacts that scene. They went all out. They just made the set. They, you know, it was incredible. And so he did about 2 minutes of that dialogue, cursing, and, you know, we recorded the test. We did the test with the film camera in the Ford director and then two witness cameras close to it. We didn't have a rig at that time, but we knew that if we didn't have any markers on the actor's face, we had to somehow come up with a way to create geometry from it. And the idea was that we could create geometry out of lighting and textures, especially if we do some kind of a triangulation. So the most amount of information we have, the better the triangulation is. So having three cameras there was the way to do it. We also knew that the witness cameras are always great, but they're always, you know, not really taken care of. There's always stuff in front of them. They are just always not being paid attention to. So we decided, well, what if we, number one, we get great film, great cameras that are witness cameras, but we attach them to the director's camera. So they can never be put away by anybody. And also we are going to have to be, you know, the cameras will have to be attended by the camera department. That's great because camera department is number one on the set. So after doing the test about 8 weeks, we showed the test to Marty and Bob De Niro, and they loved it. And that basically greenlit the movie.
So you developed this three-camera rig for the main camera and then two infrared witness cameras?
At the time, for the test, we did not have infrared. The reason why we went infrared for the witness cameras, which was the rig that we used for the whole movie, was because as we were developing the technology of creating geometry from light and textures, the differences between the key and the shadow, the ratio, it was too much. And so we had to have a way to neutralize the differences between the key and the shadow side. Because the actors did not want to go into a controlled environment situation, the idea was that it was a markerless, no helmet cameras, no little cameras in front of them. And also, the performance was going to be on set. So it was theatrical lighting and also the only time that we were going to get the performance. They were not going to come back and do a control environment. Control environment meaning we're going to control the lights and the space, the volume. So that was it. When we got the results of the test, even though it looked great, we realized that to do a production model, to do 1,700 shots for the show or something like that, it was going to take some forward thinking. So the only way to control the light is to do it in a different spectrum that the director is seeing. So if the director is seeing everything RGB, then if we basically inundate the set with infrared light, then the light, if it's coming from the cameras, from the position of the witness cameras, then the infrared light neutralizes the light direction. So what you end up with is an image that doesn't have any shadows. So then we created basically a ring of infrared lights that is put in front of the lenses of the witness cameras. Because we also realized that just by flooding the set with infrared light wasn't enough. Because infrared light works like any other light. So it creates shadows depending on where it is. But if the light is being directed from the lens or around the lens, then there is no shadows. So we spent about 2 years doing this rig, and we worked with Ari in Los Angeles and Rodrigo Prieto throughout. Rodrigo was in another
project. So Rodrigo Prieto, the cinematographer, got involved at that point.
Yes. I mean, I felt really bad because I was just basically dictating what the rig was going to be and how big it was going to be, and he wasn't involved. So I called Rodrigo, I have worked with him on Silence, and I told him, you know, what we were doing, and he got involved just to take a look at what we were doing. And so we created basically a rig that was 30 inches wide. Mm-hmm. So the center camera is the RGB camera, and then two film-grade cameras, two Alexa Minis on the side, that were modified by Ari to be only infrared. And we put the rings on the lenses, and then now this rig that was 30 inches long could go through a door frame. Because you see, what happens is that in the United States, the door frames are 32 inches wide. So we had to go 30 inches so that we knew we had 200 locations. So we had to put the camera through a bunch of stuff. And then there was a weight of the rig that was about 84 pounds at the time. And when we first put it on the technocrane, it just went to the ground. So we had to shed about 20 pounds of the rig. So finally, and we ended up with the poundage was about 64 pounds. Yeah.
How did that size dictate, or did it dictate, the types of shots that were staged?
No, it did not. I mean, it basically, we never said no to the, you know, to the director or the DP. We never put any restrictions or any movement. We put that rig in the on a technocrane, on a jib bar, on a, you know, three sticks, on a dolly. We even made it so that we could, there were two Steadicam shots in the whole show. The first shot of the whole movie, and one little shot in the middle of the kitchen on one scene. But other than that, there was no other Steadicam. But we did manage to put two cameras in the Steadicam. And then, because Scorsese usually works in two setups, so they're usually, you know, conversation pieces, so he grabs the two sections of the conversation at the same time so that he doesn't have to do pickups. So it's all part of this actor, you know, ready, you know, performance. So we had three camera setups. And so in the Steadicam, we put two cameras in the Steadicam because that was the weight. And then we turned on the other, the second setup that we had to give us three, basically, infrared witness cameras. The thing about the rig is that the rig is married to the software that we developed. We knew that we had to get information from lighting and texture, and then we devised a way to get the information that we got from the set. But then we had to take those three cameras and then figure out a way to compute the three cameras with RGB and infrared into one setup that would give us geometry.
Hello?
Is that Frank?
Yes.
Hi, Frank. This is Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, yeah.
Glad to meet you.
Well, glad to meet you, too, even if it's over the phone. I heard you paint houses.
Yes, yes, sir, I do. And I also do my own carpentry.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
So the next step is the software that you used. Would you explain what that software does, and then who did that information go to?
Right. So now that we had a way to capture the performance with no markers and on set, then we had to have a way to decode that all that information and make sense of it. So the first thing that we did is develop a piece of software that would take the RGB information and we'll take a look at the light and textures and create geometry from it on a frame-by-frame basis. So what it does is takes a look at the information and then compares it to a digital, you know, human that we have built that matches the contemporary actor, you know, a 76-year-old, 79-year-old, whatever that actor was. And then deforms the mesh to match those things, the original digital double. And then it creates that one frame, and then it moves to the next frame, and that's the same thing for the, you know, for the rest of the sequence. That's when we started realizing the limitations of the system, because an actor has a phone in his hand, or there's somebody that, you know, because of Scorsese, they put people in front of it, and smoke, and glass, and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of occlusions. So to do that, then the witness cameras would help us, because the witness cameras were, you know, separated from the center camera, and in that case, it would give us information that was behind the occlusion. To do that also, part of the setup in the rig was that the cameras were running at 48 frames a second and a 45-degree shutter, because we needed the sharpest images possible, you know, on the witness cameras. So the software took a look at the RGB camera, then it took a look at the infrared cameras, and basically it computed the three camera information into one triangulated piece of geometry. And then did that about 1,700 times for the show, and then we were done.
And that was delivered to ILM. And then tell us about the work that happened over there.
Once all that information came to ILM, then the software works basically like a black box in which you put all kinds of information and then you press a button and then the computer, the system just computes everything. So the first thing that we need to do is do the match moving. And the match moving has to be straight on, not only through the three cameras, but also there's a matchimation of the head and the shoulders and the body of the actor, because we're going to replace completely by computer-generated renders, you know, all the way from the shoulders all the way to the top of their heads. So first, that layout. Then there is a, because the system works on lighting, then there is the HDRIs and all the information that we take on the set has to be basically decoded and put into a rig, into a light rig. Also, every one of the setups was lightered, but it wasn't like usually happens on set that you just go twice, you lighter the set and that's it. We had to do it every time because every time Rodrigo changed the lights, the lighter will give us the information of where the instruments were. Because then we combine the lighter with the HDRIs. The lighter will give you the position of the cameras and the HDRI will give you the intensity of the lights. So we put all that together with some rotor work just to make sure that we only, you know, worry about the head and the shoulders and the neck.
And then to be clear, from the neck down, you used the actors.
Yes, we used the actors for what they were. There was a lot of also manipulation of the bodies because throughout the show, they basically gain weight as they gain age. So we had to take some weight out of them at the beginning of the project. And then basically you put all that stuff in it, inside the box of this piece of software that we call Flux, and basically takes all of that information and it gives you, you know, every, you know, renders every frame for that. But that only gives you the performance capture of the old actor. Then there's the retargeting part. Throughout the process of, you know, shooting, we also developed digital doubles for the actors at their ages, but also we had variations for the actors depending on how old they needed to be throughout the film. And so for De Niro, it was like from 24 to, the whole film is like from 24 to 83 until he dies. But visual effects took like from 24 to about 60. And then after that, it was makeup. So we had a model that went through about four or five different variations of ages. And then we took, you know, that performance that we capture as a 76-year-old, then we retargeted that performance to whatever age we needed for the film.
To create the look at the different ages, did you go back and look at old films or tell us a little bit about that development process?
Well, there was, we spent about 2 years building libraries for the three actors for the targeted ages for all these different films. So we cataloged those entries either by subject. Like, for instance, we had a library that was only for eyes, only for nose, only for mouth or chin, wide shots, close-up shots, exterior shots, interior shots. There was all kinds of ways that you can look for information. And then we created an AI system that basically, after we render a picture, we would input it into this AI, another kind of a black box, you know, close software that would look through all the library, would run through all the whole library, and it would just give you a snap of shots that looked like the ones that we were rendering. So, and it looked at lens, you know, size and also lighting direction and rotation. And it was just incredible. It was a really great sanity check for us to take a look at what we were rendering and how did that compare to other films. I think the important thing there is that, you know, Marty wasn't going for, when we, you know, rewind to 30 years before, he didn't want to see Jimmy Conway from Goodfellas. He wanted to see Frank Sheeran as a young person. So he designed, you know, that character to be different than whatever he had done before. It's the same as if you were looking at Untouchables, you know, in whatever year that was, and you saw De Niro look like Al Capone, you know, and he had gained weight and lost, you know, hair, and then you said, you know, wow, I wanted to look like Deer Hunter, you know. He doesn't, because he was designed for that character, and that's exactly what he did for, what Marty did for this movie. He designed those characters to be different than anything else that he had done. One specific case is, for instance, Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci in this movie at 53, the way he was never that thin, you know, in real life. So we did take a look at Casino and Goodfellas and Even some other stuff like Home Alone and those kinds of things, because it's kind of like the age. But he was never that thin, and Marty wanted that character to be thin. And the same thing with Al Pacino.
So in those cases, you worked with the actual body, but you were able to shave off some of the weight, basically.
Yeah, some of the shape of that. Same thing with Al Pacino. We look at Heat and some other movies around that time. But we know that Hoffa, Al Pacino plays Hoffa, so he plays like from 44 to about 62 when he dies. So we knew that we weren't going to go really, really young, that these characters were going to be 30 years younger, but, you know, the actors are, you know, 76, and Al Pacino was 78 when we shot the movie. So that was the idea. I know it's difficult. You know, I thought we were going to go a lot younger in certain cases or different. But Marty really wanted to design those characters in a specific way because he thought that those characters had a really rough life and they had lived in a specific way that was different than the way we live now.
Now, Marty's longtime editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, edited this film. How did that impact the editing department?
Well, from a production point of view, everybody knew, all the creative team knew that they had to turn over shots early. So they, and you know, having worked with Marty before, I thought that was never going to happen. And I thought also they were informed that if they changed takes after we started working, it was basically a do-over because we had to recapture everything, rematch move everything, recalculate the light, redo everything. You know what? This movie has been 3.5 hours for about a year and a half. They have not changed a thing. I think they omitted like 20 shots in 1,700 shots. It's like it never happened to me in 30 years. They turned over 50 shots while we were shooting. So because they knew that we had to develop the software. And the way we developed software was kind of like running the Grand Prix while you're building a Ferrari. You know, kind of like, you know, you're pushing it. At some point, you jump in it, and then you get a bunch of people fixing things. And we worked for about a year and a half in all the shots. And at the end of the process, we went back to some of the shots that we did at the beginning, and we changed them because the software had gone so well. And also because it is a brand new piece of software, there was no artist for it. And so we had to train, you know, about 50 artists that were coming from layout, from effect sims, and because basically it's between layout and effect simulation and lighting is basically what this software does. So towards the end of the process, we ended up with a generation of artists that were completely different than the way they started. And the dailies was completely different also, because in dailies, usually you have layout dailies, so you can have TD dailies or compositing, or sometimes TD and compositing goes together. In this case, we all had to be together, layout and lighting and compositing, because we needed to make sure that problems could be solved in different disciplines, and also all the flux people. So sometimes there was a flux problem that, you know, we would say, well, it's going to take flux longer than if we solve it in compositing, or if we solve it in layout first and then we give it back to flux. It was an incredible, you know, process. Dailies ran really long. Like, we started at 9, and, you know, it would be like 12:30. We'd still be in dailies talking about shots.
I was one of 1,000 working stiffs until I wasn't no more.
You got a good friend here. You don't know how good a friend you got.
Russell, he took a shine to me right away. After a while, he started giving me little things to do.
What was the age or the performance that kept you up at night that really gave you the most trouble?
You know, it's funny because I think that all the shots and all assets were completely the same level of difficulty. You know, yeah, I know that when you build a show, you say, you know, well, there's like easy shots, medium shots, and hard shots. All the close-up work, hard. It doesn't matter what asset it was. If the behavioral likeness is not there, you're in trouble. It doesn't matter how good your textures are, how much pores you have in your face, or you render. You know, for me, it is about the performance, because this project was about performance. If you don't have that behavioral likeness there, because you're going for the likeness, you have nothing. It takes you out of the picture. So it's been an incredible, you know, process of understanding how we emote, you know. And I know it sounds cliche, but we actually did not use any keyframe animation at all. I mean, everything that we have done is all computer solved for the capturing of the performance. And then the retargeting is not a math problem anymore. It's a challenging of design and how you get there. One of the reasons why we did not use keyframe animation is because there is a lot of genetic connections that are made for us that we have no control over that make us who we are. And those connections are not known to anybody other than the person who makes them, the actors. That's why if we put an animator in the middle of it, as good as an animator is, and I love animation for other projects, it wouldn't have the information needed to come up with the likeness of that actor. And so we let the computer figure that one out, especially because we didn't have markers. So we know that if you take historically a look at animation capture, we started with, I don't know, 10, 15 dots. Then we went out to, you know, 30, 40. Then, you know, now we're about 200 or so, something like that. And basically what we're looking for is a resolution of the mesh that is created by the dots. The more dots you have, the more resolution you have, right? But you can't do thousands of markers on the face because it takes you 2 hours as it is right now for 138 markers. But now we don't have to deal with markers anymore. Now we have to deal with the mesh and deformation. And so all these little things that De Niro does with his chain all the time, and the fact that Joe Pesci can move his eyebrows from left to right in different directions, incredibly, you know, and we learn all that stuff by looking at those performances, is being captured by the software without having to come up with that, because an animator would know that.
So what did the actors say when they saw their younger selves?
Well, the first test, you know, is that thing that De Niro says, you know, hey, you know, you just gave me 30 more years of my career. You know, that was really funny when he said that the first time, and now he repeats it all the time. Oddly enough, it probably will give us 30 more years in our careers if we get this right, I thought. but they were very guarded. You know, they loved the stuff. I think there is also an understanding of this is what I look now and this is what I used to look. And the whole film is about the passage of time, I think. And that's why the movie is 3.5 hours. but it's also a look into passage of time from somebody that has lived, you know, a full life and has a lot more to live. But it's a completely different perspective. You know, it's the same perspective that you have when you're a kid and you remember your room when you were a kid in it, with a specific, you know, size. And then you go back to that room, you know, 40 years later, and hey, this doesn't look like it. This looks smaller. It's that thing that Marty has arrived at, that he sees everything through that lens.
So let's talk about the impact this could have on the business. I assume you started to show the process to other directors. Are you getting... Yeah. Other projects that...
Yeah, we are getting a lot of other projects. Well, I'd say probably about 3 or 4 with scripts that were somewhere, you know, in some shelf, and they're seeing the possibilities. I think the achievement is really the markerless performance on set and the fidelity of the performance that we're getting. So I just can't wait for all the actors to take a look at this and say, you know, kind of like... What? I don't have to wear 138 markers on my face, and I don't have to go through 2 hours of makeup, and I can actually do what I'm hired to do, which is do a performance with another actor in a set environment that doesn't require me wearing a great pajama suit, you know?
So for the projects that are going to be using the technique going forward, is it driven by the needs of the story, or is it something that traditionally you would have done it in a different way, and then this is just the technique that they chose?
Well, in this particular case, it was driven by the methodology of the actors, what they wanted to employ, and number two, by the story itself, because we knew that the editing was going to be back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and we had 3 assets, right, 3 actors. If you were to say, I'm going to cast every actor in you know, as a younger person, it would have been impossible for the audience to follow that story and to keep the connections between the you know, the older Frank Sheeran and the younger Frank Sheeran, and the same thing with the other assets. So it's completely story-driven, and I think that it's kind of like the definition of it, you know, visual effects following the story and making the story happen for the audience. Marty asked me a couple of times, he said, you know, by the way, he did not review intermediate takes. You know, we would take a look at, he would turn over the shot, we would work on it for, you know, 8-9 weeks or whatever that took to do the shot, and we would show time. And then he would react to it as a final, you know, whether he thought that was, you know, could go in the movie or not. Generally, it was a good reaction. He never actually questioned the behavioral likeness. He would ask us for more texture on the skin or put some, you know, wrinkles on the top of the eyelids or something like that, but it was never about the performance. And then if there was a problem, we would negotiate, you know, how we would bring back something that he felt it wasn't in the original select.
You said you used makeup for the later years. Do you find yourself working more closely with the makeup department on a film like this? And how are those decisions being made? Or, you know, are there instances where you would combine both techniques?
Well, working with the makeup department was great. We knew, as you take a look at this whole huge project that we've been working on for 4 years, you basically have to pick your battles. And you say, okay, I can do the faces. I know I can do the faces. I know that the hair is going to be trouble because it's going to be a lot of sim work and a lot of grooming work. And I know that the clothes are going to be a problem because of sim and things like that. So we said, what if we work with the makeup department to get the hair from the set. So basically, we would replace the faces, but not the hair. Well, it turns out that the edges of the wigs are a problem. So we ended up cleaning up all the hairlines anyway. So we had to render hair. But we would meld it with the makeup work. Throughout the visual effects work, there was no makeup on the actors. There was no markers, and there was no any kind of beauty makeup. There was a cream that we put on the actors just so that it would take away the highlights. Because remember, the software takes a look at lighting, so if there's highlights, the deformation changes there. But other than that, at some point, we go into makeup. So when you take a look at the movie, you have to kind of back yourself from that point. In terms of visual effects, there's a section of the movie around when Jimmy Hoffa goes to jail, and that the three characters switch into makeup. And at some point, there are some shots that are CG, and there are some shots that are makeup in the same sequence. Because we had to basically do a proof of concept in CG, and then gave it to makeup and see if it would work. And then we back ourselves back into makeup, but. It was great working with makeup. I think at the beginning of this project, I worked with Bill Corso. I don't know if you know him, but
right. Yes. Yeah,
he's a great makeup artist. And I talked to him about this project, and he said, well, you know, the problem with us, he said, he was talking about makeup, is that sometimes our actors don't look like the likeness that we know of. And we have that problem. I said, we have that problem too. We have a model that basically doesn't change, right? Which is completely different than life, because an actor, when he shows up on set or she shows up on set, they have, like, they ate differently, they exercise differently. There's 108 days in a shoot, so who knows what they're going to look like, you know, throughout their. So I said, we have the same problem. I said, how do you fix that? And he said, well, I go in and paint, you know. And I thought, wow, you know, maybe we shouldn't develop one asset. You know, maybe we should develop an asset that basically is a free-moving asset that basically could be painted very quickly, you know, in 3D or in 2D, just to get to the likeness. So working with Carla White, you know, that she's the makeup person for Bob. It was great to work with her. And I just got an email from her, you know, saying that she saw the movie and she loved it.
Now, he also wore contacts.
He did, yes. That was also, we needed to back ourselves from that. We thought about it we talked with Marty. He was adamant that he wanted Frank Sheeran to have blue eyes because the original person had blue eyes. And it was a risky decision because at some point in the movie, we switched to contacts. Now, for the visual effects work, he didn't wear contacts. So we had to match into the contacts. But the contacts ended up too bright. The reason being that throughout the movie, there are like four different looks. There is a Kodachrome look, there is an Ektachrome look, there is a push one stop, and there is a normal. And I talked with Rodrigo about it, and we were looking at that stuff, and he had to basically decide, we had to decide on the contacts based on the basically work print, you know, was coming as work print from the DI. So we, you know, made a commitment, and then we we ended up having IMATs for every one of the shots throughout the whole movie because we had to change them. They were too bright.
Can you believe this weather, Frank?
Huh?
It's 85 degrees outside. Perfect.
Hey, Tony, Jack.
Jimmy.
People freezing to death in New York, and look at us.
Huh? Hey.
Why we don't live here all year round is what I want to know.
Oh.
Beautiful.
It's summer.
What?
It's summer. People aren't freezing to death in New York. It's summer.
In my mind, it's always 8 degrees in New York. I'm making a point.
Making a point? Making a point dressing like that? Is that how you dress for a meeting?
And this is how you dress in Florida? In a suit?
For a meeting? Anywhere. Florida, Timbuktu, I dress in a suit. For a meeting. And you're late.
What impact do you think this process is going to have on schedules and budgets going forward?
Well, I think that if you take the burden out of the actors, that burden doesn't go away. It gets spread throughout the production. So first one that hits is the camera department. So the camera department now doubles in size because now you have three cameras instead of one. And because of depth of field differences in infrared, you need a focus puller that is only for those cameras. There's one for the RGB camera and another one that works with the two cameras, with the two witness cameras. So then there is that. Then there is the production design because, you know, like I said, the rig has to has a certain weight and a certain, you know, length and it has to go through different parts of the set. So the set has to be built that way. And then in terms of post-production, there wasn't really no much difference. We could have gone with what everybody else was doing, which was marker stuff and control environment, and it would have taken the same time. The only thing that we invested was in R&D and creating a completely brand new way of doing things and creating a brand new artist kind of type. But other than that, there is no financial or post-production impact. In other words, we didn't take longer because we were doing this. There is one project that we're using it right now on, but it's for a different thing. You see, this is used for de-aging, but it could be used for something else because you could get the performance and then retarget it to a creature that has nothing to do with the actor that did it. See, what this does is frees the actors from having to do their performances somewhere else. Also, research tells us that whatever our eyes are doing, our body does. So if you take an actor out of the set and you put him by himself or herself on a control environment in front of, even if it was a different actor, you know, just so that for an island, that doesn't do it. Because that actor, when you're taking a look at Joe Pesci and De Niro, when they look at each other, they're not only looking at each other's eyes, they're also looking for each other's feedback, you know, whether that person understood what you said or not, and they're reacting because they're ad-libbing. They're also on set, and they're checking out something else, you know, that is going on in the background, and they go back to them. If you're in a control environment, you ain't going to have that. That's the other thing that happened to me. I mean, I worked with a performance capture on other movies, you know, for 5 or 6 years before I got to this. There's a reason why I did this project. I had been working with the other system before. And I sometimes would look at a shot and say, you know, there's something wrong there that happened in the performance. I can't really put my finger on it, but I have to deal with it. Well, now I know. It's the other stuff that happens. It's that what the actors call the truth, you know. I remember working with Ewan McDonald in a movie. He showed up on set and it was all blue. And he said, "What the F is going on here? It's all blue. I can't, you know." Well, you know, I thought, well, I mean, he's an actor. He should be able to do that. You know, now I understand. It's not just about that. It's about the truth that they feel when they are with each other, you know?
In addition to this, the rest of the work on the film from a visual effects standpoint, I imagine a lot of environment work?
Yes, there's a period work. There's like three or four shots that are a gem, really. There are a combination of starting on location and ended up inside a set. Like there's some shots of starting in the middle of the street in New York and going inside Umberto Clam's house. What happens inside Umberto Clam's, that's in a set. But we started the shot on location in New York, so we had to match both things without motion control, because motion control is a thing of the past now, right? So we got that to work. There is a really long shot, about 4,000 frames, of a barber shop where somebody gets killed. Well, that was a set, but the bodyguard exits the shop and goes into a location. It was the Roosevelt Hotel in New York. And those two sets had to work, and I gave Marty three or four options. I said, "Well, you can start with the bodyguard. The bodyguard goes by, and then we stay with the person who's going to get killed, and then we switch pan into the other set." And I gave him like three different options. He says, "No. I want to stay with the bodyguard." "Yeah, but the bodyguard goes, you know, right from one set into location." I said, "Yeah, you'll figure it out." So we morph between, you know, in the bodyguard, between one take and the other one. So it's working with Rodrigo and Scott, you know, the camera operator and everybody else. That was also a Steadicam shot. So very difficult work there that is very difficult to tell because nobody will, you know, it's basically thankless, you know, because nobody knows, you know, what we did. You know.
Well, congratulations on the film and thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.